Amen. All right. Yesterday, we made it through Hanukkah, which, what was the date of Hanukkah or the cleansing of the temple? When did it begin?
December 16th, 164.
Yes, drones, that is exactly right. December 16th, 164, which is 3 years to the date after the abomination of desolation. And we're just going to dive right in, so hopefully you're okay with us moving. At this point, many of the Hasidim, I've mentioned them a couple of times. They will become more important as we get into John Hyrcanus. But the Hasidim, they're kind of the Jewish religiously fervent group. Okay, it's kind of hard to exactly describe this group, but they are religiously fervent. In other words, they're the non-secular group of Jews. They're the ones that would not be necessarily for Hellenizers. Now, the reason why I'm giving a clear and yet vague definition of them is because even within a particularly like religiously fervent group, you're still going to have a spectrum. You're still going to have a spectrum of people of in order they would consider themselves religiously fervent, but they could interact with the empire in a way that is, from the people that are more hyper-conservative, would seem almost on levels of betrayal. Okay, so even within a conservative group, there is a spectrum of conservative as well as quote-unquote liberal, which is why on some level those terms are losing their meaning. Because now, I mean, my goodness, you have conservative liberals even in America, and yet there is levels of conservative that people even want you to know that there is a difference between that type of conservative and the type that they are. You know what I mean? And you have the same thing here with the Hasidim, and we'll get into that more clearly. But what right now, whenever I mention them, what you need to think is religiously fervent group. Okay, and within the Hasidim, even though they had received religious freedom, or at least not freedom, but a religious restitution, there was no more ban on Judaism. Within the Hasidim, you still have people that are just not satisfied. Many of them are not satisfied. Specifically because what does Antiochus do, even though he retracts the ban on the Jewish people, what does he still do that causes a problem? Yeah. Menelaus is still the high priest, which is not going to be something that people are okay with, because Menelaus is not of the Zadokite lineage. He has been bribing. He is seditious. He is ridiculous when it comes to that. So he appoints him. They're not happy. They have achieved some religious restitution, but they did not see this as the end of the battle. Okay? Judas and his brothers decide to take this to a new level. So you have them. They're the zealous revolutionaries. You have these religious fervent. Even within the spectrum, you have some of them that are like, it's good enough. This is close enough. But not Judas and his brothers. In 163, they set their sights not just on religious independence, but on political independence. They want to be their own nation. They want to be their own separate people, not under the subjugation of the Greeks at all. So in 163, Judas moves to strengthen their position. He does this by doing two things. So he moves to strengthen their position the goal is to gain political independence. So he strengthens their position in 163 by doing two things. Number one,
good grief. What am I doing? I wish that wouldn't do that.
Number one, they transplant Jewish communities in Palestine and in the Transjordan to Judea. In other words, they're consolidating. They're grabbing communities that are not necessarily within if you bring in the forces, it's going to be harder for people to divide and destroy you. So they resettle the communities into Judea, closer to Jerusalem, so that they can consolidate power. So that's step one. of regaining political independence, consolidate your resources. And in this case, it's people, it's communities. Okay? Movement number two, and this you could probably guess, is to gain new resources by raiding new territories. Specifically, they are raiding to the south. If this is the Jordan, you have your Mediterranean, and so Jerusalem's down here. And if you have right here, this is Samaria. And eventually it'll be Galilee. It isn't right now, but eventually that's Galilee, and this is where Jerusalem is. Idumea is down here, which that'll be important later because that's what Herod the Great will be. He will be an Idumean. And that's where they go. They start to raid the people to the south. Okay? So they consolidate power, bring people in. Some people in the Transjordan bring them into Judea, into this area to consolidate power. Once you consolidate power, then to gain more resources, you start to find new places to go. Samaria's relationship and the contention that they have with them is probably not the wisest place to go first. Go south, and that's what they do. They start raiding Idumea and Philistine-type territories. That's 163. In 163, in May of 163, so we're still in the same year, Antiochus dies. Antiochus dies while fighting the Parthians out in the east. He dies, though, from a sickness. So Antiochus dies in May of 163. And from Judas's perspective, this is a major opportunity. If from Judas's perspective, when Antiochus dies, where do you think the first thing he's going to go at? What is the first thing he's going to go after? High priest position. And that's exactly what he does. He goes after and he besieges Menelaus in the Acra in this kind of little bit of a citadel. So he goes after Menelaus. Menelaus obviously is freaking out, sends word up to Lysias, who is up in Antioch. So he sends word up here to Antioch, saying, hey, they're coming after me. They're going to kill me. Come help me. Well, Lysias then comes south with a royal army. He moves south. Okay, Lysias, I'm sorry, you don't even need to necessarily know that name. It's just a general. Okay, you don't even need to know that name. Let's just say a Greek force led by a to-be-named general named Lysias comes south. And he meets Judas and his brothers and all the rebels in a war. And for the first time, Judas and his brothers are defeated soundly. Now, Judas isn't killed yet. That'll happen later. But they are defeated soundly. And the big reason why? War elephants. It's the first time they'd engaged war elephants against the Greeks. It's been, what, 25 years since they had to get rid of all their war elephants in the Roman Peace of Apamea? Well, since then, they've accumulated some. And Lysias uses those, or the one general, uses those against Judas and his brothers and defeats them soundly. However, the Maccabeans, their movement still advances. Even though they have a defeat in the battle, they still gain a small victory because Lysias realizes that if they are going to deal with this situation, Menelaus cannot be the high priest. Menelaus as the high priest is just causing more and more problems. And so, finally, Menelaus is deposed. Menelaus is no longer the high priest. Because Lysias is going, how many times do we have to come and rescue this guy? How many times? They do not like him. Let's just get rid of him. Now, he does it after he beats them in a battle. He beats them and says, but I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to depose Menelaus. And instead, he appoints a guy by the name of Alcimus. So Alcimus is the new high priest. Alcimus, a couple of things about him. He is not a Zadokite, so we still haven't fixed that issue. He's not a Zadokite. He is not a descendant of Zadok. But he is a Levite. That's a step in the right direction. So Alcimus is not a Zadokite, not of the direct lineage of the high priest. But at least he's of the priestly lineage, and that's a Levite. However, if you are Lysias, or if you are the Greek Empire, and you appoint someone to move a step towards them, what else, though, who else is going to be a primary candidate? What are some of the qualities, though, from your perspective, you're going to look for when you appoint someone? Yeah, somebody's going to push your agenda. I mean, you need to find somebody that they can't rage against. And on some level, they keep saying, but Menelaus is not even born of the right lineage. So you're like, well, at least I moved one step further. However, Alcimus is a Hellenizer, big time. I mean, he's going to be pushing the Greek agenda inside of Jerusalem. So you have a victory by the Jewish people, but it's not going to be one that satisfies them. A victory, sure, but not ultimately a solution. So, you also have this other key problem, and that is, you have Onias the fourth, he's still alive. And so you have Judas and his brother saying, we have someone. Why won't you allow Onias the fourth to be the high priest? Well, it's because he's not a Hellenizer. He's not like his brother Jason. He's not going to be doing the beck and call. He's going to actually be a high priest. So the problem is still, it's a step closer, but it's not ultimately going to be the solution. Okay? Tracking with me so far? In case you haven't noticed, today's one of those days we're going to gain a lot of ground, and we'll process towards the end, but we need to gain a lot of ground. Okay? We good? Not at the sake of clarity, though, so if you're not getting something, just raise your hand and stop me. Okay? All right. Okay, so Antiochus dies. Now, this is something else that's happening simultaneously. Okay? When he dies, this is what's happening from the Jewish perspective that's the most important. Menelaus getting rid of him. From the Greek perspective, though, there is a vacancy of the throne. And naturally what happens is people are fighting over it. I'm not going to get into who all fights over it. Eventually, a guy by the name of Demetrius takes power. Demetrius is now the ruler over the Seleucid Empire, or the dominant force in the Greek Empire, especially in this region. Yep, so Demetrius takes power after Antiochus' death. Demetrius takes power. I mean, whenever a new person comes to power, you always see this throughout history. When a new person comes to power, you have a strong group of people that will go to this person and make requests. You see this even in small moves of power, not just big ones. But you'll see this whenever Paul is imprisoned in Acts 20, 21 and following. And you see a shift of the governor of the region from Felix to Festus. And whenever Festus takes power, the Jews come back. And after 2 years, they start making requests about Paul that at that point had kind of gone stale. And if you're Festus, you're wanting to figure out a way to try to show the people in the region some benevolence or good faith. Why? Because in order to actually have a good beginning to a reign, you need to make sure that you get on everybody's good side. And then once you give everybody a little bit of a gift, then you can kind of sink into your own agenda. So Demetrius takes power, and immediately the Hellenizers, led by Alcimus, go up to Demetrius and start to complain about Judas and his brothers. And Alcimus says, they're not accepting me. It's kind of one of those, like, they've taken the ball and they won't let me play. It's one of those feelings. And Demetrius is like, well, this is unacceptable. You're the high priest. You're the one that we have suggested. So we're going to send down Bacchus, who's a governor of the region. You don't necessarily need to know that name. We're going to send him down, and we're going to make sure that you get installed. Well, the Jewish people reject this. And they meet Bacchus, and they meet the forces that are there to install Alcimus. And it ends with Alcimus running away for his life. Because they're like, no, we do not accept you. Okay? So, that's creating, in other words, the reason why that's important is creating tension that's about ready to climax. All right? In 161, Judas sends a delegation to Rome and makes an alliance. Now, Rome has already kind of tipped their hat towards the Maccabeans, saying, hey, we actually think that you need to continue doing what you're doing. But a formal alliance is something that is different. Rome makes a formal alliance, and they encourage Judas to fight for his independence, promising different ways of helping them. Why? Why would Rome do this? Where is Rome right now? What do they have control over? Almost this horseshoe, right? So you have Italy over here, Greeks, the Greek islands, Asia Minor, Egypt. Rome has got this pretty much secure. But this is the region and the gateway to the bigger goal that they're going after. And this is where the Seleucids are reigning. If Rome can develop an alliance, send in different types of support, whether we're talking soldiers or money or something to the Jews, and they continue to fuel their revolt, it will actually weaken the government that Rome does not want to continue to be successful. This is something that even governments today do. Matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why this situation in Syria has been very chaotic and confusing. It's because you have multiple governments supporting different parts of the side. So actually what's happening is inside of the revolution or the civil war in Syria is a greater war being fought by other countries fueling and funding each of the sides for their own purposes. So because you're not going to have superpowers directly right now going right after each other. Instead, what they do is they let, especially in key regions of the world, they let revolutionaries fight a lot of the wars for them so they can save resources and face and things of that nature. That's what's happening here. Rome's funding them so that they can weaken the Seleucid Empire. Okay? That makes sense? 161, in response to this allegiance to Rome, this treaty with Rome, or this alliance with Rome, not treaty, but alliance with Rome, the Seleucid Empire dispatches a large army against Judas. They are not happy. They dispatch a large army, and the Judeans were soundly defeated again, and this time Judas is killed. So the death of Judas Maccabeus, this is in 161. Judas is killed after the Seleucid Empire is responding to the Roman alliance. In 1 Maccabees 9:21, at Judas's death, they cry out, "All Israel said, 'How is the mighty fallen, the Savior of Israel?'" So Judas is dead. He is buried in Modain, which is where his family comes from. His father was a priest in Modain whenever the sacrifice was being implemented. Another fallout of this, so Judas dies at this battle. Alcimus is firmly installed as the high priest. The Hellenizers have clear control. You see what precipitates. So Judas dies. Alcimus is clearly as high priest now in the region. The Hellenizers are gaining more control. And the supporters of Judas start to be treated very poorly. Which is typical. I mean, if you're the one that has the power and you mistreat people, well, what happens whenever those people gain the power? That's the struggle. They gain the power, and now they are mistreating the ones that, and in some ways, were mistreating them. So this is 161. Once Judas dies, it's not as if the entire revolution ends. Now, it does look like momentum is lost, but Judas... it's not at his death that the Maccabean revolt is over. Now, that might be the perspective of the Greeks, but there's two reasons why the campaign for independence is very much alive. Number one, the remaining Hasmonean brothers, or the remaining brothers of Judas, they refuse to stop. Matter of fact, there were five of those sons of Mattathias. Judas was one of them. But they are determined to gain independence. So their sheer determination, matter of fact, a lot of times the death of a person can even compel a movement because now you have a martyr-type figure to rally around. And is their death in vain if you do not continue to fight? And the answer would be yes. Therefore, in honor of the fallen martyr, we will rally around them and continue to fight harder. So that's kind of step one. Step two, In other words, what else is continuing to fuel the momentum? You have the brothers' determination. But you also have, you're going to be have fighting, jockeying for position still over the throne. Even though Antiochus is dead and Demetrius has made it, there are still strong divisions inside of the Seleucid Empire fighting for the throne, for positions of power. And a kingdom divided will fall. This is a very clear thing that Jesus points out even in Mark 3. When you have a kingdom that is struggling to stay unified, you have a kingdom that is very vulnerable. And that's where the Seleucid Empire is right now. And we're still in kind of 161. We're about ready to hit 159, but let me give you one more detail, okay? And I know you're taking down a lot. You're doing fantastic. We just have to get through this sometimes. Judas's youngest brother, Jonathan, is the one that becomes the leader of the rebel cause. Jonathan is appointed the leader. Now, to be totally honest, Jonathan is not anything like the military tactician that Judas was. Jonathan just, he's not like Judas was as military. But he actually is quite diplomatic. Not as diplomatic as what we will see Simon being here in about 10 years or so. But Jonathan's diplomacy advances their cause pretty well in a pretty clear fashion. So Jonathan is the ruler now of the rebel cause. Okay? Do you need to like stand up and take a breath or something? You guys doing okay? Your hands all right? Okay.
Hey,
yes.
What was the second one when talking about the revolution doesn't end after Judas' death?
The fracturing, the segmentation of the Seleucid Empire.
Okay.
So when they're fighting over the throne, Demetrius is still the clear power, but you have people making plays for the throne. And whenever you have internal strife, it's going to weaken your ability to completely subjugate or to destroy a revolt. So the termination of the revolutionaries as well as the weakening of the Seleucid Empire because of fragmentation. Okay? 159. Alcimus dies of a stroke. Alcimus has a stroke and dies. First Maccabees 9 credits this to God's sovereignty, his punishment. But in 159, Alcimus dies of a stroke. And the high priest position is vacant for 7 years, from 159 to 152. It is vacant. Well, I mean, why is it vacant? There's several reasons. I mean, I think at the very base, like crass level, it's because Demetrius is going, every time I appoint a high priest, it ends in some sort of war. If you're not going to be happy with the one I give you, you're not going to have one. I mean, there's something of that in play. Okay? So Alcimus has a stroke, dies. For the next 7 years, there is no high priest. And over this time period, actually, when Jonathan is reigning, it's relatively peaceful. As a matter of fact, from 157 to 152, there's no recorded even skirmishes. It's peace. Which, I mean, depends on how you look at it. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, if you're one of the revolutionaries, not really having any sort of attacks means that there's no major advances. At the same time, they've been in war for quite some time and they might just be tired. But nevertheless, from 157 to 152, there is relative peace. Until 152, out of nowhere, some guy comes on the scene claiming to be the son of Antiochus Epiphanes. He calls himself Alexander Epiphanes. No one even knew this guy existed. Alexander Epiphanes comes on the scene. He has a lot of support from people in various regions. And Alexander Epiphanes makes an alliance with Jonathan, the ruler of the revolutionaries. And Alexander Epiphanes and his alliance appoints Jonathan as the high priest. Now, there's weirdness with this. Okay, so let me recap. 152, Alexander Epiphanes comes on the scene claiming to be Antiochus Epiphanes' son, which means he has the rightful claim to the throne, not Demetrius. Alexander Epiphanes has a ton of support. He sees the rebel cause as something that can be used to his advantage, so he makes an alliance with Jonathan and the rebels. And as a part of the alliance, he appoints Jonathan high priest. Now, here's the weirdness of this. While Jonathan and his family have been fighting for like the rebel cause to restore, you know, Israel to what it is, to Judea and Jerusalem, Jonathan is not of the Zadokite lineage. And I mean, so let that sink in a moment. Like, they're going like, we want you to fight for us, but we did not ask you to be the high priest. You don't have a claim to that yet. Or you won't, because you don't have the right lineage. You cannot claim that position. So you're actually going to see a weirdness starting to develop even within the Hasmoneans. This whole family, Mattathias and his sons and those that come after, is referred to as the Hasmonean dynasty. Okay? So that's something I've been using off and on. It's probably finally time for us to just see it and call it what it is. They are known as the Hasmoneans, the Hasmonean dynasty. You're going to start to see, and this happens sometimes, whenever you have people that rise up in order to meet a need, sometimes they get a taste of the power and it's hard for them to accomplish the greater task because they would have to give up something of what it is they have acquired. That happens a lot. Even in ministry, that happens. Where somebody begins in a very benevolent posture, ends up restoring something, and then what it is they've acquired in the restoration, they don't want to let go of. That happens. Quite dangerous when it happens. Yeah, Lydia.
How is Alexander allowed to make Jonathan the high priest? Like, what happens with Demetrius? Like, does he just, like, not have a problem with it? Or,
No, that's a great question, because here's what ends up happening next. Alexander and Demetrius go to war. That's what happens. 150, Alexander and Demetrius go to war because it was a part of Alexander's jockeying for position to get the throne. So in other words, even though he appoints him, he's doing stuff unilaterally that Demetrius is not recognizing. So eventually the tension rises, they go to war, and Demetrius is killed. That's in 150. So Demetrius is killed, and this is why this is the diplomacy of Jonathan is somewhat heralded, because Demetrius is killed, and now Alexander Epiphanes is the one that is in power, and who is the one that got behind him before anyone else did? Jonathan. That's going to be rewarded. So he's already been appointed high priest. Now, when Alexander gets power, he says, because of your service by aligning behind me, I'm also going to make you governor of the region, which is one step closer to political independence. You see what it is that Jonathan acquired. Jonathan picked the right side. Once Alexander comes in, now Jonathan is both governor and high priest. One step closer to something we're going to see emerge for the first time, and that is king and priest being held by the same position. That's not happened yet, but that's one step closer. Yep.
So did the alliance between Rome and Judas dissolve when Judas died?
Not necessarily. Rome is still supporting this cause. Okay?
So technically, Alexander, fighting for the Seleucid throne, was fighting alongside Rome.
Not from Alexander's perspective, nor Rome's perspective. It's kind of like, if Jonathan's the middle person, and Rome's got an alliance with them. Just because Rome has an alliance with them doesn't mean that Rome has an alliance with everybody that Jonathan has an alliance with. Rome has an alliance with him.
Is that going to cause problems?
It can. Rome has a different agenda in the alliance than what Alexander does. But if you're Jonathan, you're trying to make both of them. Countries do this all the time. What happens if you are a country and your ally attacks your other ally? Then what do? Well, you have to make a determination of which ally you actually are going to be aligned with. Put you in a precarious situation. Right now, they may not be friends, but use both of the people that are enemies. Sometimes when you can become an ally, you can use their enemies against them. You can benefit from two enemies wanting to fight for your attention. You can benefit from that. And that's the line of diplomacy that Jonathan's walking, and it's a very fine one. But that's That's part of what makes him so incredibly successful, or remembered as more of a diplomatic leader as opposed to a militaristic one. Okay, I thought there was another hand. No? Yes?
So there were no plays against Jonathan to remove him from the high priest position?
Not at this point. Now, in other words, the people do not see Jonathan as a complete restoration of what it is they long for, but it's a step in the right direction. Way better than Alcimus or Menelaus ever was. Okay? But it still will become a problem eventually. And there's probably an expectation, well, we'll even see this when John Hyrcanus, there's an expectation that at a certain point, once a prophet arises, or once we finally find somebody, or it's opportune for Onias the Fourth to become, that he'll hand it over. But right now, hey, let's just be thankful for what we have. But eventually people will become disgruntled about that. Okay? Okay, in a series of events, which I'm not going to go over in huge detail, after 150, so you can just put this kind of 150 and after, because exactly when this happens is it's kind of hard to delineate, but let's just say after 150, Demetrius' son, yep, that's right, he's got a son, comes in and overthrows Alexander Epiphanes. So his reign is short-lived. Demetrius II becomes in control. So now we have Alexander's out again. And Demetrius, we're just going to say second and kind of resurrect that thing I put on the board. Demetrius II is in power, but he does something very interesting. He summons Jonathan not to punish him, to solidify the alliance. Because what he realized was that the closeness of Alexander with Jonathan was able to be used for Alexander's great, great gain. So Demetrius II says, instead of creating an enemy out of somebody that was a problem for my dad, what if I just make them an ally? So Demetrius II comes to power. He confirms Jonathan as governor and high priest. Why? Because the people were okay with that. And that's what you want. If you are trying to restore power to the Seleucid Empire, you want stability. You are desperate for stability. So he confirms Jonathan as governor and high priest. Okay? We good for the next date? Man, we are cruising. This is great. You guys are doing awesome. Okay. 143. Unceremoniously, there's nothing really quite significant about it, but Jonathan dies. And what I mean by nothing significant, it's not like there was like an assassination or anything. He just, dies. 143, he had ruled then for 17 years, and upon his death, Simon, his brother, takes power. So Simon the Hasmonean in 143... becomes governor and high priest, the leader of the rebels. Okay. What does Simon do? Simon is remembered for gaining political independence. Ish. I mean, that's what he's remembered for, but it's kind of like, I mean, I guess you're politically independent. But in 143, whenever Simon takes power, upon meeting with the Seleucid Empire, Demetrius II, he makes some clear demands. He says, we will strike an alliance with you, but here is the key. We no longer have to pay you any sort of tax. Taxes are very symbolic of subjugation. If you no longer have to pay someone tax, it's because you do not belong to them. You are separate from them. You are independent. So Simon comes to power and he says, we will be aligned with you, but we no longer belong with you. We no longer belong to you. Does that make sense? So they agree, and the Jews are essentially independent. And 1 Maccabees 13:41 describes this moment as this. In the 170th year, the yoke of the Gentiles was removed from Israel. So they very much see it as a political independence. Okay? This is where Simon's remembered as a diplomat that even surpasses Jonathan. Because Simon also strikes an alliance with Rome simultaneously. A strong alliance. So now they are politically independent from the Seleucid Empire, and the Seleucid Empire is okay with it. And then they strike an alliance with Rome, and Rome is okay with it, kind of. Rome takes this to another level, though. Rome writes the Seleucid Empires and the surrounding kingdoms, and this is what Rome says. If anyone attacks Judea, Rome will come and attack them. Rome says, we recognize them as completely independent. They are our allies. If you mess with them, you are messing with us. Now, that from the Judea's perspective, that's exciting, but it also is because Rome is using this alliance to send a message of their intentions. Why? Because this is such a strategic location that it's virtually inevitable somebody will come after it. And then Rome has a political justification to come in. Okay? So Rome has its own agenda in the background. But Rome sends a letter to everyone around saying, if you attack them, you attack us. However, the people loved it. The people in Judea were so excited about what Simon had done, that in 140, the people of Judea appoint Simon as commander-in-chief of the entire army. He is the army leader, the military leader. They say, we want you to lead our military as an independent nation. We want you to lead our military. The people also appoint him governor of the nation, king of the nation. And the people appoint him high priest. He holds all three positions at once. Now, there is a significant difference between Simon holding this position and Jonathan. Jonathan held something similar, although they didn't add the, you are commander-in-chief. The difference is this, though. Who was it that gave Jonathan his position of influence as governor of the region and high priest? Yeah. It was a foreign ruler. Right? The foreign ruler is the one that said, Jonathan, you're high priest. They're okay with that on some level. Simon's is different, though. It is the people of Judea that say, you are military leader, you are the king of the region, and you are the high priest. The people have appointed it, which is a different level of, really, authority. What's the key problem? Say it again. What's the key problem, though? He's not of the right lineage. He's not high priest lineage, and he's not of the lineage of David. So there's going to be a problem. Now, this is the caveat that people put in. We're appointing you this until a prophet comes and tells us what to do otherwise. That's the caveat. Okay? So there's still this belief that even though you are filling these roles for us, you're playing a part in God restoring us when a prophet comes and tells us otherwise. Regardless if you are alive or dead, you will relinquish the power and give it to who the prophet says. Okay? In 135, Simon is assassinated. Power, man. Power is brutal. People will do anything for it. Just watch House of Cards. Good grief. Simon is assassinated in 135 by his son-in-law at a banquet, actually. It's a family gathering, which makes it all the more delightful. And his son-in-law had aspirations to take over all of the power of Simon once he assassinates him. But he also would know that he was going to have to kill all of Simon's sons, all the other people that could claim the power. Series of events, he's not able to. Okay? So his son-in-law doesn't. Instead, one of Simon's sons by the name of John Hyrcanus takes power. John Hyrcanus takes power. It's his son-in-law. His name's Ptolemy, but there's so many Ptolemies floating around. I don't know if that's really helpful for you. But it's the son-in-law of Simon. And John Hyrcanus is kind of the one that's really directly associated with this reign of the Hasmonean dynasty. Now, all of this has kind of been the Hasmoneans, but John Hyrcanus is kind of the golden age leader. I mean, it's been 40 years since Antiochus had outlawed the Jewish religion. They have restored that. They have overcome that. In these early years, John Hyrcanus has kind of a golden age. Everything the people had hoped for has happened. As a matter of fact, Josephus even suggests that John Hyrcanus has the ability to predict the future, making him king, priest, and prophet, which is a fascinating shift. Because what were they waiting for? They're waiting for a prophet to come and to tell them who should be the high priest. Well, isn't it convenient that John Hyrcanus is all of them, so now he can say, I am the one that should be in charge, because I am priest, prophet, and king, which is quite convenient. Hyrcanus's goal when he takes power is to expand Judea to the size of the time of David. That's his goal. All of it. He wants it all. He initially moves south. Poor Idumeans, they just get hammered. Moves south and attacks the Idumeans, forcing them to become Jewish by forcibly circumcising the boys and the men. So that's his first move. Move south. What can you guess is his second move? There's only one other key direction. Yeah, north. And that's a big problem. He attacks Samaria. As a matter of fact, Antiochus, I'm not even going to tell you, never mind. A ruler of the Seleucid Empire tries to intervene. It's Antiochus the Ninth. I mean, do we really want to be counting these at this point? A ruler of the Seleucid Empire tries to intervene in his attacking of Samaria, but Rome steps in and blocks Antiochus' ability to intervene. And so what happens? Well, the Samaritans were already circumcised, so you can't really go there. Instead, what they do is they destroy the city of Samaria. They completely destroy the temple on Mount Gerizim that the Samaritans had made. And it deepens the feud between these two. That goes back at this point already to, 500s. I mean, it goes back to the Persians whenever they allowed the Jews to come back and start rebuilding the temple. Remember that? That was 400 years earlier. Now, they have already said, fine, you don't want us to build your temple, we'll go build our own. John Hyrcanus goes north, not only destroys their city, but destroys their temple. This is kind of like their Babylon moment. And it's at the hands of the Jews. Again, this will make the strife or the tension between the Jews and the Samaritans in the first century a lot more clear. They hate each other. In a similar fashion that you see the Jews vilifying the Babylonians because they destroyed their temple, now the Samaritans have their temple destroyed by the Jews. Okay? That's John Hyrcanus moving forward. So you have this expansion. You have John Hyrcanus, who has all this power. He moves south, then he moves north. He's expanding it, trying to get it to the size of David, when internal strife starts to happen. Because some of the Hasidim, I told you we would come back to them. Some of the Hasidim are not okay with John Hyrcanus being their king and priest. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of tension between the Hasidim and John Hyrcanus because they did not think that he was following the religious path. Politically, maybe they were okay with it, but not religious. So John Hyrcanus throws a banquet, trying to improve his relationship with the Hasidim. And at the banquet, a question was asked that basically says this. Wasn't your mom, John Hyrcanus, wasn't your mom held in captivity by the Seleucids? Now, she was, but there is a veiled something in that question. Why? Well, because when a woman is held in captivity, a lot of times she can be used as an object. as a way of punitively dealing with the people, to sexually violate all of the women that are in captivity is a way of, in a sense, exerting your power over them. So when they ask the question to John Hyrcanus, hey, wasn't your mom held in captivity by the Seleucids? They're basically suggesting this. Are you a bastard child? I mean, can we even prove that your dad is who your dad is? I mean, because if she was there with the Seleucids, you know what they probably used her for. That's not going to make John super excited. It's not going to make him particularly favorable towards them. He didn't take it very well. He considered it an insult, an attack on his leadership, and he broke off any relationship with the Hasidim, which many believe the Hasidim then begins to fracture. Now, this is very important. I know we're down to the last minute, but you're going to want to catch this, okay? Some of the Hasidim fractures off and becomes the group known as the Pharisees. The majority of them do. Now this, again, this is very contentious, highly debated, but this breaking of John Hyrcanus with the Hasidim, the people that were religiously fervent, when he says, enough's enough, I have nothing to do with you, the majority of that group, they believe, becomes the Pharisees, what becomes the Pharisees. Hyper, hyper meticulous of the law, keeping the religious fervency always at the front of the people, but also people that are no longer politically affiliated with those that are in control. Remember, if you remember back in Acts, you have the difference between the Pharisees and Sadducees. Pharisees, when it comes to the Bible, they're considered hyper-liberal because they have the oral law, they have all of the Old Testament, but it's because of their meticulousness of the law that was being violated whenever they were created as a people. But politically, what are the Pharisees? Considered very conservative. They have nothing to do with the empire. Why? Because originally, the empire had nothing to do with them. And then John Hyrcanus aligns himself with some other religiously fervent people that eventually become the Sadducees. Now, why would the Sadducees prioritize the first five books of the Old Testament but not the rest? Well, because it's the rest where the lineage becomes an issue. If you only prioritize the first five books, you don't deal with the Zadokite lineage, you don't deal with the Davidic lineage, all that's gone. Now, because of your political or your theological liberalness, cutting off half the Old Testament, now you can be politically affiliated with the person that's in control. So the Pharisees and Sadducees don't arise out of nowhere. They arise in this type of a moment where they're both trying to figure out how it is that they are going to move and advance their political and religious agendas. Okay? We're going to redo that tomorrow, that part, just those Hasidim part. But until then, I love you guys. See you then.